Today, our speaker is Dawn George, and she comes to us with a variety of experience and talents. And every time I have to introduce someone here, it always amazes me, actually, within our group, the people who are members, just what, you know, what a whole group of people we have who are just so great and so talented. It's amazing. You know, I think we just are very blessed to have this kind of community and the people who are willing to share with us. So anyway, Dawn actually has an interesting background. She was born in the West Indies, and you'll detect when she speaks a little bit of New Orleans accent. And then she went on to New York and the East Coast. And she went to New Rochelle College and graduated there with a BA in math and a minor in philosophy and religion. Then she received an MS in math from Notre Dame and a certificate in religious studies from Fordham University. So she has a good background in those good, Jesuit schools. and she taught math and religion for a number of years. So after spending her life sort of on the other coast, she decided to come to California because we're so great and it's a good place to come. So when she came here, she was planning to get a PhD in math at UCSB, but she found that at that point in time, there was a glut of math teachers in the area. So she decided, being very resourceful, that it was time for her to retool. So she decided that she was going to get a degree or a certificate in marriage and family counseling. And so she started on this, and then also, in the meantime, she met Don George and married him and became instantly the mother of two teenagers. So her life was very full. So anyway, she did go on, got her marriage and family certificate, and then she found that she wanted to go on and do more, so she went to Pacifica to get a PhD in philosophy and ended up teaching at Pacifica for 11 years and also had her own private practice here in town. So she has had a myriad of experiences. She also was part of the program and ran Casa de Maria for several years. And so she is here today to talk to us about Chapter 4, Wednesday of the Last Week. Dawn George, and would you like to come up here?
Yeah, thank you.
We would like to sing the blessing to her. And I like the old blessing, and I think many of our speakers like it. So if you would all like to stand up.
May the blessing of the Lord be upon you. May He bless you in the name of the Lord. May the blessing of the Lord be upon us. We are blessed in the name of the Lord.
I'm sure I'm not the first one who gets overcome with emotion. with that blessing. Oh gosh, there's so many things I want to say parenthetically before I start. One of them is that when Liz and I talked about her introduction of me, she asked me if I knew anything about the Enneagram, and I said yes, and she thought I might be a 9. And I have to say that's a compliment, because peace and equanimity, which is typical of a 9, is not typical of me. I want to open with a quotation that is says more about me, perhaps, than that. And then I those of you who are Enneagram aficionados would know. I don't want to give away who wrote this quote until the end, but it is, we're always wanting to stamp becoming with being. We're always wanting to stamp becoming with being. It's sort of like we always want to get to the destination and not enjoy the journey. And that is maybe something, a statement I particularly take as an important admonition. And as you see the outline that I've provided for today, you can see already I'm trying to stamp the becoming of this talk with being. What I have put up there for those of you who might be a little far away and find it difficult to read is the outline of the passage that occurs on the Wednesday of Holy Week, what will become the Holy Week of Mark. It's chapter 14 and the first two verses, the need for a traitor, verses 3 to 9, the unnamed woman, and then finally the other side of the frame, verses 10 and 11, the advent of a traitor. The overall approach of what I'm going to do today is, first of all, look at this passage from a sort of scriptural exegesis approach, the kind of thing we've been doing, you know? And then secondly, because I have a background in mythological unpacking, to take a mythological, psychological approach to the same passage. Not to be contrasted, because they have a great deal of overlap, but you have here a sort of roadmap of what I'm hoping to do. I want to begin by reading the text for today. It's, as we see here, it's only 11 verses long. And it reads this way. So let's situate us in that week as we've been reading Mark these past 5 or 6 weeks. It was 2 days before the Passover and the festival of unleavened bread. The chief priests and scribes were looking for a way to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. For they said, not during the festival, or there might be a riot among the people. And now while he was at Bethany in the home of Simon the leper, as he sat at the table, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very costly ointment of nard. And she broke open the jar and poured the ointment on his head. But some were there who said to one another in anger, why was the ointment wasted in this way? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and the money given to the poor. And they scolded her. But Jesus said, let her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has performed a good service for me. For you always have the poor with you, and you can show kindness to them whenever you wish, but you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for its burial. Truly I tell you, whenever the good news is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in remembrance of her. And then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priest in order to betray him to them. When they heard it, they were greatly pleased and promised to give him money. So he began to look for an opportunity to betray Jesus. Certainly, this is a very clear example of what Bourde and Croissant brought to our attention as the typical way of presenting the story by Mark. That is this wonderful word, intercalation. Interesting word. The frame around a passage. And he says that this sort of literary device is not just, oh, maybe the work of a distracted author, but it has a purpose. And the purpose is that we look at the inside, the picture, say, by the outside, the frame, and that one comments on the other. In fact, I think that we could say this is a wonderful example of an adage that at Pacifica was very much what we would call the mythological approach to looking at anything, and that is how you see is going to determine what you see. It's sort of like another guideline to the one that Anne brought out so wonderfully a couple of weeks ago when she gave us the Mary Had a Little Lamb, that the context is everything. So the context is everything is an important guide in reading, but another guide to reading is the juxtaposition of text so that we can take a particular point of view in looking at something, because how we see determines largely what we see. My intent is really to put more emphasis on the picture, so to speak, what's inside the frame. But I won't do it without going back to the frame, because I think that sheds a particular light on the text. In terms of this unnamed woman, this is a remarkable statement that Jesus said. Truly I tell you, whenever the good news is proclaimed to the world, what she has done will be told in memory of her. Amazing. This title so struck one of the feminist theologians of, I'm dated right now, especially 20 years ago, she was at the top. She says here that what she does is she takes her book, A Feminist Theological Reconstruction of Christian Origins, and she titles it In Memory of Her. Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza. I think she now goes only under Fiorenza. Or it's only on the, she's dropped one of those two names more recently. So what we have to say when we think of this inner story is, what a story. You know, what a story. While he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he sat at the table, a woman came in with an alabaster jar a very costly ointment. And she broke the jar and poured the ointment on his head. So our job now is to sort of unpack these seven verses and see, you know, what is there. If I first start to unpack it using the comments that we have in common, those that are in the textbook and cross on, we find that he first brings to our attention the extravagance. Or the text points out that 300 denarii, which is the price they said they could have sold, was a year's wages. Imagine a year's wages in today's market. If we take, say, you know, maybe a median of, say, $40,000, ointment worth $40,000. I mean, I don't even know what that would look like to have a jar full of an ointment that's worth $40,000. How did she get it? Now, how did she happen to have it in her possession? When the disciples were lamenting that they couldn't feed the multitude of 4,000 people, the cost for bread then was one-tenth of that. And that, of course, was a huge amount of money, $4,000 to feed the crowd, you know, and one of the miracles was this miracle of that. But this is $40,000. So Borgen Croissant at, you know, is she to be remembered because she was extravagant? And he basically says, I don't think so, even though that's something we don't want to not notice. He says that we need to see that she is to be remembered because in some way she was the first believer. And how does he come to this, that she's the first believer? Well, for some of this, I also go to the writings of Suzanne, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, Hein or Henny? Anybody know? Hein? Okay. She reconstructs for us the times of Jesus and the times of those people. And she tells us that we know that the women who followed Jesus were not only those who provided meals and lodgings, but other material needs as well. But in addition, they were among those who heard the sayings. And she takes places, other passages, to show us that they were participants in the public life of Jesus, not only as sort of like outsiders. That these sayings of Jesus, which we could call the red letter verses, you know, those sayings of Jesus, he makes it clear that that those who followed him in complete participation, with just a few examples when Jesus maybe took just the apostles aside. I think because they were hard of learning. And they needed a little bit of tutorial. So it's not a big jump for us to imagine that she was there when Jesus said a couple of the statements we have recorded earlier in Mark. And there were two other statements. One is Mark 10:32. We are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priest and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. Then they will hand him over to the Gentiles, and they will mock him and spit upon him and flog him and kill him, and after 3 days he will rise again. Now, most likely this isn't something Jesus said at that time. It quite possibly is something that came in later, because the purpose of Mark's gospel was to sort of show that everything was known. But who knows, maybe Jesus did say that, and not many people got it. And she got it. She got that he was going to die. And then also, at that time, in fact, later on in the same chapter, Mark 10, Jesus said, when they were talking about, it was after the incident in which I think it was the two sons of Zebedee wanted to be one on the right and one on the left, you know. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever should be great among you must be the servant. And whoever shall be first among you must be servant of all. For the Son of Man came not to serve, not to be served, but to serve. And so we have Mark and Croissant commenting on why she should be remembered. Not only because she gave testimony to her belief in his death, but the manner in which she did it was in the manner of the servant. She poured the ointment over him. She came in that way. And so the second point that he makes as to why she should be remembered, in addition to being the first one who believed that he was going to die and be buried, but that this was an example of paradoxical leadership. The first among you will be last. Those who would want to serve must serve others. You know, from John, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, and then he takes off his outer cloak and puts like a towel around it, and he goes and washes their feet. And we commemorate that by calling it Mandatum Thursday, where mandatum is the Latin word for a new commandment, well, for the commandment. So we have her here remembered wherever the gospel is preached. But there's something that certainly must catch the eye of many of us, if not all of us here, is that she's unnamed, you know, and she's a woman. Suzanne Hine, in telling us about some of what was typical at the time, not only were they included with the disciples, but she says that we have to be a little careful not to project back into the Gospels the misogyny of the first three centuries of the church, where we have such memorable phrases as woman is a misbegotten male, and, you know, like, woe is you if you're born a woman, phrases like that. She said that actually the Gospels were written, for sure, from an androcentric perspective, because the writers saw it very much not only as Jesus' story, but, you know, their story as they're telling it. And from that, we might be surprised at how many stories there are of women. But as he goes to look, goes to look at the community around Jesus, she said what she sees in that community, what is typical, and the typical of so many of the phrases of Jesus, is that there was this discipleship of equals. This phrase that I just pointed out, that if you want to be the greatest, you must serve. And that one of the passages on that was the passage, I find myself all of a sudden drawing a blank and not having the page, so if you just give me a moment. Do you all have problems of forgetting? No. Mine is accelerating like I wouldn't believe it. And well, I'm not seeing it, but that's okay. Okay, I think I have to just let that go and pick up wherever there's a thought. Just by a loose end. I might be able to come back to that again, because one of the things I discover as I find that I black out, and I do that, you know, just about everywhere, is that it comes back. So it was there all the time, you know. Annoying. So what I'm going to do is then go to one more point that Borg makes, besides the point of that she was the first believer, that this is an example of a paradoxical leadership style, and I want to come back and finish that point. But that her way of being with Jesus and in the group is contrasted with Judas. Okay, we see it here in the phrase, with Judas. And that's going to be part of what I hope to do in the last section, is do a certain, use her and Judas in contrast and play with that for something that might be useful for us in living our lives in general, but living our lives of faith. A few more points, though, on the scriptural interpretation of the text is what Elizabeth Schussler-Fiorenza has to say. Is she looks at this passage from the point of view of what the woman does. And she pours this ointment out on Jesus. And in pouring the ointment out on Jesus, she follows a tradition, and that is the tradition of the prophet who anoints the next prophet, or anoint, like Samuel anointed David. Mm-hmm. And there are many more examples that I can't bring up quickly. I want to just read a little bit of what she says, because it's good. The story of the anointing of Jesus by a woman articulates this insight. It's the final form, in its final form, it's told by a community that has already envisioned a worldwide mission that wherever the gospel, the good news of the kingdom is announced in the whole wide world, that this practice, this praxis of this woman will be remembered. It's sort of an exemplar for us to anoint, you know? This is something to think of. Is Dorothy here today, Dorothy Fitch? No. No. Dorothy gave me something on a very, you might say, secular level years ago, and that is she told me about jojoba oil. And I go through quarts of jojoba oil. Jojoba oil is the only oil besides whale oil that penetrates all seven levels of the skin. And it is available from a plant, and it is just so wonderful. You can buy it at the farmer's market, or you can buy it online. And I almost brought some with it for us to anoint one another, but I didn't know how logistically I could fit that in. So this idea that she publicly anointed Jesus for his burial, and you might say that in some way we can anoint ourselves and one another also for our burial, because we will die, but also to keep it. Imagine it goes through all seven levels of the skin. J-O-J-O-B-A. Jojoba. So she says, she publicly names him as a prophetic sign action. She has spent much money to do so, and she's reprimanded sanctimoniously by the male disciples of Jesus. Could have been given to the poor. Those disciples who have projected their messianic dreams of greatness and dominance on Jesus use the poor as an argument against her, but Jesus defends her. You always have the poor. You can, you know, you can anoint them with jojoba oil or give them food. But me, you don't get it, do you? I'm going to die. And it's going to be soon. So she goes on, now is the time to decide to do good. Thus, in remembering that a nameless woman, prophet, has anointed Jesus as the messianic inaugurator of the kingdom, the Basilia, the community also remembers that the God of Jesus is on the side of the poor, and that God's future, the kingdom, belongs to the poor. She goes on later, and I think in a touch that's quite lovely, she says, suppose we reverberate that passage. This will always be done in remembrance of her with the Eucharistic formula. Mm-hmm. Take this and do this in remembrance of me. It's kind of a nice juxtaposition of two passages. Okay, so let me just see if there's anything. There's one other little point which I'm sorry if I leave you with this, but another point about that Susan Hine mentions in her exegetical work about, you know, looking at the scriptures and then looking at any passage in terms of it. I've never heard it lectured on, but that there is in the text of Mark, but I think in all the synoptics, a kind of hostility from Jesus to the family. Mm-hmm. Would be an interesting thing to collect all those texts. You know, who's my mother out there waiting for me? You are my mother. You know, if any man wants to come and follow me, let him leave all of these and come. That would be a hard thing to work on, but I think it could be interesting. One of the details of my biography that Liz left out is that I was a nun for 20 years. So I left mother and father and the possibility of kids and all the rest when I was 17 years old. Because what I had was a kind of vapid West Indian life, you know, lolling on beaches and drinking rum and coke. And as I look back on those 20 years, one of the advantages of going into religious life is that I got educated. When I had told my father I wanted to go on to college, he said, but you know, how would you find somebody who'd want to marry you then? You know, you'd be a misfit. And then he names the one or two women who were educated on the island. Look at them, you know. One was a vet. And people used to make fun of her that she looked like a horse. I mean, that was the response to women. And I think that some part of why I left religious life 20 years later was that I was struck so profoundly, not only at the college in New Rochelle where I was teaching, but here in St. Anthony's, here in Santa Barbara in St. Anthony's, that one did not have to escape to religious life to be on the journey. That you did not have to leave mother and father and sister and brother, in spite of the gospel, that one could actually find a call right here. And so at that point, you know, that idealism that I experienced at 17 so powerfully sort of fell away. And so much for that. So the hostility to the family, boy, that was drummed into us to some extent in religious life. And, you know, when I left the West Indies, you know, I did not see my father again, though he died 5 years later. My mother then came back to the States. But you didn't go home in those days. I was in an order that was very strict. My brother, when my father had died, passed through LaGuardia. It was 20 minutes away from where I was. And I couldn't go to the airport to see him on the flight in and out, even though, you know, my brother called me from England to tell me he'd be at the airport. You know, that's how it was. Mm-hmm. But that was faithful to this part of the gospel. But it's, you know, maybe that was an example of stamping a kind of becoming with being, a kind of rigidity that was followed in religious life. Let me just pause for a second. I want to get to this other part. But anything anybody wants to say, either from your own study of this passage or from your own reflection as I've been talking, that would be from, say, staying very much with that. Mary.
Significant about the fact that she had to break the alabaster jar rather than pour out of it. I know ointment, unless it's semi-liquid, won't pour. But mm-hmm. Is there any significance about that?
No, I don't know, but I do know that jars often were sealed. Yeah. You know, like you as a you know, your nursing background, like an ampule.
Yeah.
You know, where it's sealed for protection, and so you have to break it and get the stuff out. Yes, Christine.
It says she broke open.
Oh, okay. So it
broke the jar.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Okay.
So it was a seal.
It was a seal that she broke open.
It's worth $40,000.
Yeah. Yeah. Mary.
One thing that occurred to me as you were talking about this woman, that she's following the tradition, the first believer, also seems to me that you could look upon that act as encouragement. I mean, even when we know, who popped in my mind was Oscar Romero. And he spoke, you know, of, you know, the fact that he would be very likely to be assassinated. But everybody around him denied that.
Uh-huh.
And I think that would be the case with Jesus too, even though he said it, the people might have had an inkling. But she, in doing this, preparing him, might have been encouraging that and just facing up to it.
Uh-huh. So, let me see how I got it. That in anointing him, she was encouraging him.
She was acknowledging that she, the danger that he was in, and that he was going to die, and that that was reality. She was looking at the reality of the situation.
Yeah, she certainly was reality-based. Anybody have a lozenger? I'm a little bit more raspy than I would need to be. Thank you. Okay.
There, you probably are going to get to this in your mythological, psychological approach, but there are have been several times when this particular story has come to mind in experiences in my own life, and the latest one was the day that Father Virgil died. That morning, when I went in, we had a vigil set up, and I went to relieve the person that was there, and I could see that that was probably going to be the end. And he wasn't, he didn't have his eyes open, so he wasn't alert or talking. But shortly after that person left, I was there in the room by myself, and in comes Brother Joachim. Mm-hmm. If anybody knows who Brother, he flies into the room like an angel in a brown robe. There's just something very ethereal about him. And I mean, even his face. And he said, "Oh, you know, I just want to give a blessing. You know, like just take a minute." And I said, "Fine." And I stood back. And he went over and hovered over Virgil. And out of his mouth came these words that we often hear in the last rites, that usually some of it is offensive to me. But it was totally by memory and just flowing out. It was the most beautiful thing I ever experienced. And then he turned around and off he went. You know? And I went over, and I was so touched by it. And this is what came to me. It was an extravagant perfume being poured in an anointing. And I said that to Virgil. I said, "Isn't that the most beautiful thing you could ever have experienced?" I said, "Isn't that why you love our Catholic tradition? Wouldn't it be wonderful if all prayers could be said with such love? Isn't that why we love Joachim?" And a huge tear just rolled down his cheek. But I feel in experiences like that, she's remembered every time in our own life that comes to mind in our own personal experience. But I really felt that Joachim had anointed him for his death at the beginning of the day that he died. It was beautiful.
That's lovely. I've often thought in terms of, you know, who among the people I know, because it's certainly not part of my temperament to be like that extravagant woman, you know? And over, Ginny Cashwood comes to mind. Ginny knows that that when she takes a new step, she often has to find crying me. Tom.
Let me indulge me for a second while I ask whether, instead of labeling this woman as a prophet, because we don't know that, just imagine if she might have been the woman taken in adultery. Just imagine if, as an adulteress, she could not have a normal marriage and had to do prostitution. Just imagine if she was still loved by Jesus. Just imagine if, as a prostitute, she came into the favor of princes and others who could afford these alabaster perfumes. Just imagine if she said to herself, "My love for Jesus is greater than my sin, mm-hmm. and I'm going to be give him the best I have."
Mm-hmm. I'm going to move on now, if you don't mind, because I want to have a little sort of like cycle of thought, which I need to get to the end for it to sort of hold together in the mythological, psychological approach. actually, you're going to say, I don't know the difference between this and what we've been doing, because in many ways they're all the same thing, you know, but there's some slightly different, maybe, part of the journey. At Pacifica, there's really an anomaly, and maybe not an anomaly, but I think that there is a high incident of Catholics, or what they prefer to call themselves, recovering Catholics, because just exactly what Alice said, we have such a rich mythological within the Catholic Church, and that many of the Protestants, where they bring something else to the experience of Christianity, they still didn't want to, they wanted us not to be quite so orthodox, you know, but then the part of the Protestant Reformation was to, you know, get rid of the statues and the all of that excess. But I have to say, yay for the imagination that Tom talked about. Yay for all of those kind of excesses. I never can understand, and maybe there's two sides to the argument, but the shock of people when the cathedral was rebuilt in Los Angeles, the Church of the Angels. You know, if not for our worship, you know, we can have both. We are rich enough to feed the poor and to build a cathedral that represents the best of the art available at that time. So that's also included, I think, in the story, that one doesn't have to be literally at one place versus another. We always want to stamp our becoming with being. Okay, a word I want to introduce here is meme. A meme, actually it was only coined recently by someone whose writings I don't like at all, and that's Richard Dawkins. But a meme, is that this word is used a fair amount now at Pacifica in some of their work. A meme can be thought of as like maybe the shortest segment of sort of real human activity. It's sort of like if you are looking at a text, you could say that text might have, you know, 5 or 6 memes. They are little pieces in which there's something in it that sort of describes the human activity. And I want to take that concept and apply it to this passage. And the one that stuck out at me, that came to my awareness most profoundly, was in this woman going and doing this action to Jesus. She is saying, this is the one. This is the one. This is he. That, you could say, this is it. You know, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy, you know, that boy meets girl, that's sort of like the thing that describes that moment is the mutual, this is the one. You know, so I think all of us have had that experience at some place of finding someone, not necessarily a mate for life, it could be a dear friend, in which you say, this is the one. And when you think of that, either in the present or in the past, and you linger at that moment, this is the one, what do you experience? Let's just do this real fast. What do you experience? A moment of truth.
Yeah, an inner knowing.
Inner knowing. What happens physiologically?
Warm.
A heart opening, a softening.
Sort of a completion.
A completion? You're jumping too far ahead. Okay? Because at that moment, nothing's complete. Okay? This is first love, you know? And in order for us to get a little bit more of the idea of this is the one, it's described, you could say, psychologically as idealization. Idealization. I don't know how to spell it, the board. Or illusion. Illusion is a wonderful word because the root of it, it comes from play. Mm-hmm. Illusion, it comes out of the word play. It is a moment of excitement, delight. It is the moment that an infant has when it recognizes the face of the mother. You know, so I want you to sort of visit that to get that feeling, because that's a little different from, say, the mate idea of this is the one across the crowded room. You know, I saw it. This one of the infant, this is the one. The delight. Sort of all of the systems become go, you know. It could be that of an animal recognizing you. You know, somebody will describe going to the pound, and there were all of these animals, all the research they did ahead of time, and there is this sort of sense of this is the one. It's mutual. Or this is the one. It can be true around the leader, and to some extent, you know, that was acknowledged by John McCain when he said, that man, you know, that man is a form of this is the one. I don't know if you saw the Al Smith elocution event where Barack got up and said that in Swahili that Barack means that man. So we have done a lot of play around that, so much so that, again, Barack Obama did a kind of skit of that he wasn't born in a manger. But there is this excitement around this particular leader. Today's kind of auspicious day, you know. It's the 200th anniversary of the birth of
Charles Darwin.
And somebody else?
I think Mendelssohn.
Okay, very nice. Okay, so we have this notion of this is the one. And maybe a step further, this is the one for me. In terms of our relation with Jesus or the church, we might also have this sense of this is the one. This is the one. This is the sort of the, in the evangelical tradition, this is very much, this is my Lord and Savior. This is the one. Now, the meme in literature in general, but the meme, this is the one, is nearly always paired with another meme. And that's the experience the disciples had on the way to Emmaus. And it's, illusion is followed by disillusion. Hopefully not delusion. Disillusion. Excitement by, well, it could be deflation. Inflation followed by deflation. Idealization could be followed by disappointment. Now, there's more than one word I could use here. But this pairing, and so in terms of the experience of falling in love with somebody, you know, who of us haven't said to ourselves, who is he? Or more directly, who are you? We see this in the infant. We see this in the infant. If the mother has taken too long to return, the infant is not delighted. The infant is saying, who are you? You know, you're going to have to work here. And in fact, the infant's affect might be more rage for having to wait and needs to show the returning mother that disillusionment. Dogs and cats do it too. I'm sure you've had the experience of thinking you could leave your cat for a weekend with food, and you come back and the cat is going to give you the silent treatment for a while. This pairing, okay, happens. In this passage, we don't see that pairing in one person. We don't see that pairing in the woman and her disappointment. We see that pairing in the woman and Judas. Because it said in one of the other Gospels that Judas was the one who had said this should have been, I think it's John's Gospel, this should have been sold and given to the poor, and the commentary is that Judas didn't say this because he really cared for the poor, but because he used to take money out of the purse. Mm-hmm. You know? So Judas had in some way a radical disillusion with Jesus. And he just wasn't fitting what he thought of that this is the one you should have. So I see back there Nancy quite ready for the snack. And I'm not ready, but I'm going to break in just a second. What I want us to do is to sort of think and come back, and I'll finish it. And that is that this pair, okay, of idealization and disappointment, this is very natural. In fact, it is the process by which we come to reality. This kind of going back and forth. It is as natural as systolic and diastolic in our heartbeat. Okay, it is very, very, it's the normal way. Just a second. But anytime we have a back and forth, we can swing too widely. And the too wide swing is all or nothing. And so in some respects, I'm going to deconstruct our idealization of this unnamed woman and say that she got locked in the oar. Because we don't know anymore, other than she was like perfect. I mean, she's not going to be terribly helpful to us on the journey. Because she has stamped her becoming with being in the gospel by being all. And Judas with nothing. Okay? So they are both caught in the extremes. And where we work out our life is going to be by holding the tension of the all or nothing, that is not letting it be all, not letting it be nothing, but constantly going through this kind of back and forth between he is the one and, oh, we had hoped so much, the disciples of Emmaus, that he was the one. And I imagine if you think of this and reflect upon your faith, that you most likely wouldn't be here if you had such absolute certainty. That this is what we're sort of doing, is this oscillation, this diastolic, systolic thing, okay, between he is the one. Yes, what miracles he's done in my life. And shit. You know? Certainly we can say it about the church.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, again and again and again, our disillusionment is fortified. Yes, Christine.
I wonder if this is Judas actually did get it. And so his disillusionment and disappointment is that Jesus is not the military and political Messiah that he had idealized.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah. And that the price was too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice. Let's come back, and then I'll have a few more thoughts and open it up to more discussion.